Our next case this morning is Shaw against Hyatt International.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Paul Cullen, and I'm honored to appear this morning on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, Rich Shaw. The question before the court this morning is whether a corporation headquartered in Illinois that maintains a principal place of business in Illinois and that maintains a worldwide hotel reservation system that is internet-based, 800-number-based, out of Illinois, can be held accountable under the laws of the state of Illinois to non-resident plaintiffs to whom they have given deceptive and misleading statements within the meaning of Illinois' consumer fraud statute concerning the booking of hotels in Moscow.
Relying on this statute rather than the law of contract?
Because there is no contract between the plaintiff and Hyatt.
There is none?
There is none.
Why?
Because
your argument is that the website made certain representations and that in reliance on those representations you made a booking. And indeed, you clicked on some document agreeing to the law of Illinois and so on. Why isn't that a contract?
The booking was with a third party unrelated to Hyatt in Moscow.
So what? If I go on the Expedia website and make a deal with Expedia under which they will furnish me a reservation on American Airlines to Los Angeles for a particular price, my understanding, I've made a contract with Expedia that that's indeed exactly what they'll do. And if they charge my credit card a different price or make a different booking than the one they've told me they'll make, they're in breach of contract with me. You have contracts with your travel agents. Now, the Hyatt website is serving the role of a travel agent. Why aren't you?
Hyatt is not.
I've got a contract with them.
With all due respect, Your Honor, Hyatt is not serving as a travel agent. No payments are made to Hyatt. No consideration flows.
So you think they're just doing this gratuitously? They're
doing
this as a kindness to strangers.
Oh, no, I'm quite confident.
Look, it may be that you're just kicking away the only ground on which you can win, but I'm just puzzled by why you are taking what amounts to the travel agent's side of the question whether there is a contract. You seem to be in full flight from what seems to me your best legal theory. That's the puzzle.
Hyatt does not act as a travel agent, period.
It's not acting as a charitable institution.
Oh, no. It, I am quite confident, receives compensation for its efforts, but that compensation flows from the hotel in Moscow to Hyatt, not from our client to Hyatt.
But can we look at it this way? Who guaranteed Shaw that room at that rate on that day? It was Hyatt, wasn't it?
There is no issue of guarantee present in the case, Your Honor. Our client received representations from Hyatt that it could go to this hotel in Moscow and be paid and pay its bill in dollars. It went to that hotel in Moscow, was forced to pay in rubles at an exchange rate, at a rate that was 14% above the Central Bank of Russia's exchange rate for rubles and dollars.
Well, it seems to me that it's Hyatt.com that breached its express contract to provide that room at that rate. You know,
Hyatt was acting on behalf of its affiliated hotel in Moscow, and if there was a contractual relationship, it was between Hyatt and the Moscow hotel. It acted as a man, a shill out on the street, making numbers available, making representations available as to what my client could expect if he traveled halfway around the world and booked into the hotel in Moscow.
Look, forgive me, but Shaw made the reservation on Hyatt.com, which is not owned or operated by the Moscow hotel. And the rate was offered to Shaw by Hyatt.com and accepted by Shaw on that website. So
I respectfully disagree with the recitation of the facts. Under a 12B6 motion, of course, you have to interpret the facts in a light most favorable to the plaintiff. Here, we allege that Hyatt made deceptive representations, and our client accepted those deceptive representations and went to Moscow with the impression that he would pay his bills in dollars, and Hyatt knew all along that he would have to pay in rubles at an inflated exchange rate.
Can I try it this way with you? What are the damages that you're seeking from Hyatt International? Because if we accept your argument that there is no express contract with Hyatt, the damages wouldn't necessarily be the difference in price between the guaranteed rate and the rate actually paid. I mean, suppose that Hyatt.com deceptively stated that the rate was $500 per night when it was actually $600 per night. But every other website and the hotel itself would offer only a rate of $700 per night. What damages would have resulted from the deception?
The facts in this case, Your Honor, were that the price was announced in dollars and the website...
Counsel, I heartily suggest that you answer my colleague's question, which is a hypothetical, rather than just restating the facts of this case.
If the only hotel room available in Moscow was at the same price and they had no choice but to go to Moscow, then under your hypothetical, I suppose there would be no damages. But they could always decide not to go to Moscow. I mean, as I understood your hypothetical, Your Honor, you were saying suppose that was the only rate available for that room in Moscow. What damages would my client have suffered?
$74 a night is the difference.
$74 a night.
Difference between 14,000 rubles and 16,064,
right,
which were charged. That would be the damage.
The difference between the dollar rate converted into rubles at the official exchange rate and the rate at which the room was calculated, which was 32 rubles rather than 28. That would be the damages.
On a breach of contract.
That would be the damages under the false representations of Hyatt, because our client went to Moscow fully expecting to pay in dollars, and he was lured into that by representations of Hyatt. I don't see a contract there, Your Honor. Okay. In any event, we sued under the deceptive practices statute, and we do see deceptive practices. And that's where we filed our cause of action. And I think that's the issue before you this morning. Do we have a cause of action as out-of-state plaintiffs with respect to false representations made by a company headquartered here in Illinois? And the leading case, of course, and I think both sides agree, is Avery versus State Farm, decided recently by the Illinois Supreme Court. And it's very careful to focus that we must focus on the language of that holding, because the court in Avery pointed out that it's very difficult to determine the status and the situs of a consumer transaction. So it expressed its opinion not by the location of the consumer transaction, but it expressed it in terms of the circumstances that relate to the disputed transaction and whether those circumstances occur primarily and substantially in Illinois. Again, it's not the transaction itself, which may be difficult to pinpoint, but whether the circumstances relating to the plaintiff's disputed transaction occurred primarily and substantially in Illinois. If you look at the facts of Avery, the court found it overwhelming at 835 Northeast 2nd at 855, overwhelming that the roots of the transaction before it were not in Illinois but were in Louisiana, because the plaintiff resided there, his car was there, the accident occurred there, the repair estimates were given in Louisiana, the claims representatives and the justices were in Louisiana, the damages were in Louisiana, and insurance is regulated in Louisiana.
The Park Hotel in Moscow had stated the bill at a rate of 28 rubles to the dollar. Would you have any claim?
No, Your Honor.
So what the hotel did in Moscow is absolutely essential to your theory, which rather suggests that it's hard to treat it as an Illinois fraud.
Not at all, Your Honor. The example...
Much easier to treat it as an Illinois contract, but we've been through this.
But we brought it under the consumer statute. The example I give in the brief, I think, is illustrative. Suppose Hyatt advertised that its hotel with its name on it in Moscow had a beautiful view of the Kremlin. And suppose someone built an obstruction between their hotel and the Kremlin, which obstructed that view, and yet Hyatt continued to advertise this beautiful view. That would be a false and deceptive ad, notwithstanding the fact that they had no responsibility at all for the obstruction in Moscow. It's just that circumstances took place in Moscow that made their continued representation misleading and deceptive. So too here. They told our client that he would pay in dollars. It is not illegal to require him to pay in rubles, nor is it illegal in Moscow to require him to do the calculation at 32 rubles to the dollar. The gravamen of the offense is in the deceptive statement that they would be paid in dollars, and that was made in Illinois. If you look at the center, what I call the center of gravity of the facts here, the deceptive statements came out of Illinois. Which state, which jurisdiction has the most important claim to this transaction? Is it London, where our man happens to reside now? Is it New York? Is it Moscow, where no illegal actions took place? You have to look at the relative importance of what happened in Illinois here relative to everything else. The center of gravity, the most important things about this transaction happened in Illinois. And, Your Honor, there's only one contract that I can see between the plaintiff and the defendant, and that was the agreement that Illinois law would apply and that our man would submit himself to the jurisdiction of the courts of Illinois. That has not been honored. I'll save the balance of my time.
Did you, by the way, pay Illinois sales tax on this hotel bill or the Illinois hotel occupancy tax?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because there was no transaction with respect to this hotel in Illinois.
But your argument is that under this provision on the website, Illinois law applies, and Illinois imposes a tax on hotel occupancy.
I know, but the hotel was not occupied in Illinois. I paid a big one this morning. I know exactly what you mean.
Exactly. And the 32-to-1 conversion rate was not imposed in Illinois either. It seems to me you can't have things both ways. If you're relying on the Illinois choice of law clause, then you have to pay the Illinois hotel occupancy tax. You can't say the Illinois choice of law clause applies all features of Illinois I like and no features of Illinois law that disadvantage my client.
With all due respect, Your Honor, no hotel room was occupied in Illinois. All right? No hotel room was occupied which would subject our man to the Illinois hotel occupancy tax. The representations were made in Illinois, but the hotel was in Moscow, and it really doesn't matter whether this case involves the difference in expectations created by these false representations and the reality in Moscow. It does not turn on whether the reality in Moscow violated Russian law. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Cullen. Mr. Brooks.
Your Honors, good morning, and may it please the Court, my name is Brian Brooks, and I represent Hyatt today. Your Honor, we perceive there to be two questions presented, which are relatively straightforward. Both of them flow from the proposition that there was, in fact, a contract between the two parties. The first question is, assuming the applicability of Illinois law in the sense that there was an agreement that contained, among other things, the application of Illinois law to disputes, is that sufficient under the Avery case to create a remedy for this out-of-state plaintiff who engaged in an out-of-state transaction? That's the first question. And the second question, of course, is assuming the existence of a contract, which we think is fairly clear, what are the effects and the legal significance of that contract, both for the Consumer Fraud Act claim and for the equitable claim that plaintiff attempts to allege in the complaint? Let me start with the issue of the remedy available under the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act for an out-of-state plaintiff who engages in an out-of-state transaction. Hyatt doesn't dispute that there is a choice of law clause that says Illinois law applies. Hyatt doesn't dispute that that directs the court to Illinois rules as the set of decision-making principles for resolving the dispute. What Hyatt says is, as a substantive matter of Illinois statutory construction, the Illinois statute that is invoked in the complaint doesn't create a remedy for this plaintiff and this transaction. And the reason for that is simple. The Supreme Court said in August of last year that for the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act to create a remedy for a given person and a given transaction, either the person must be resident in Illinois or the transaction must have occurred primarily and substantially in Illinois. Now, Judge Easterbrook has I think, already done some of the articulation I would do here, but I think it helps to unpack what the elements of the transaction we're talking about here really were. There's no question that one element of the transaction involves the state of Illinois. Hyatt is, of course, headquartered here, just as State Farm was headquartered in Illinois in the Avery case. But the other elements of the transaction that we can glean from the complaint are all outside of the state. Those elements include the following. Mr. Shaw apparently sat in a flat in London and viewed the Hyatt website where the allegedly deceptive statements were made. That didn't happen in Illinois.
Speaking of London, was this case properly removed?
Well, Your Honor, the case was removed under the Class Action Fairness Act, which, as Your Honor knows, changed the rules for diversity removals. It used to be the case prior to February 18th of 2005.
Yeah, no, look, the reason I'm asking it, which may not be immediately apparent, is that the plaintiff does not appear to be a citizen of any state.
That's right, Judge. What the Class Action Fairness Act does, however, for the first time, is it directs the court to the citizenship of unnamed absent class members.
Yes, but does it allow, the question I'm asking is, does it allow removal, or indeed the presence in the class, of people who are neither citizens of any state nor non-aliens, right? Under the jurisdiction that an alien could be a class member or a plaintiff or a citizen of any state under the minimal diversity requirements of the Class Action Fairness Act. The oddity here is that the plaintiff is an expatriate, not an alien, and not a citizen of any state. And it may be that the action could come into federal court. It's not clear that the plaintiff can come into federal court.
Well, Your Honor, that's an interesting question. I think the way that I would answer the question is to say, first of all, that CAFA, like the jurisdictional statute before it, speaks in terms of removal of an action, not the removal of individual litigants or claims. So that's the first place I would begin. The second thing I would say is, prior to the enactment of CAFA, the diversity analysis focused on the citizenship of only the named parties. It was perfectly possible, and indeed common in my experience prior to CAFA, that putative classes often included people who couldn't possibly come into a U.S. court or in some other way invoke the power of the court for a remedy. What CAFA does is it equalizes for removal purposes the status of named parties and unnamed parties, and it simply asks if there is a party over whom the court has jurisdiction who is diverse from the defendant. In this case, there's concededly, and I think plainly given the class definition in the complaint, multiple individuals who are American citizens and citizens of a given U.S. state. The other answer, Judge, I think to your question, however, is that the complaint suggests, even if it doesn't make clear, that Mr. Shaw probably is a citizen of New York for jurisdictional purposes. It says that he resides in London, but both in the complaint and in the argument that we just heard from counsel, there's a suggestion that, in fact, the plaintiff never established an intention to permanently change his domicile, which is the usual articulation of citizenship for jurisdictional purposes. So either because of the language of CAFA, which says that we don't have to rely on the name plaintiff for jurisdiction, we can find any class member for that purpose, or because the complaint suggests, if it doesn't make clear, that Mr. Shaw probably is still a citizen of New York for jurisdictional purposes, I think there is a proper removal jurisdiction of the action. Your Honors, to turn back for a moment to the question of the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act, let me just enumerate what we think the seven elements of this transaction
were. Before you do, let me just ask you a quick question. When a misleading statement is set forth on a website operated in Illinois and read in London, is it your argument that the deception occurred in London rather than Illinois?
It is, Your Honor, and the reason we think that is there's nothing about technology that has changed the basic legal principles governing where the deception occurred. Consider Avery, for example. In Avery, the allegedly deceptive statements were written in an office building somewhere in the state of Illinois. They were read to a plaintiff by an agent of the Illinois company, but the agent was in Louisiana. In our view, the screen that Mr. Shaw viewed our terms on was no different from the agent in the Louisiana case. The message was delivered by means of a delivery device that was in London, not in Illinois. And, of course, our view is to read it differently from that would be to radically alter some of the common concepts of situs and a choice of law. What it would effectively say is, in a world of Internet commerce, wherever the corporation is headquartered or wherever the server happens to reside is likely to be outcome determinative for disputes of this kind, and we think that can't possibly be the right interpretation of the law on that issue.
In other words, the material misrepresentations, according to your view, occurred substantially in London.
Well, with my client in the room, Your Honor, I hasten to add there, of course, were no material misrepresentations, but taking the complaint as true, as we must today, the statements that are identified in the complaint, let's say, were viewed in London. And some other things happened in London, too. There was an act on the part of the plaintiff in London.
So if somebody viewed this website in Tajikistan, this suit should be filed in tribal court in Tajikistan.
Well,
is that really what Hyatt wants?
No, happily, Your Honor, the website addresses just that issue, which is that wherever these things are viewed, we hope that the action will be brought in the courts of Illinois under Illinois law. And that is the consequence of there being a contract which contains, among other things, a venue selection and forum selection, rather, and choice of law provision. So we won't be appearing, we hope, before the Tajikistan courts anytime soon, but wherever that happens, the law will be Illinois.
Just watch.
Your Honor, I'm confident the day that Rule 23
Supreme Court
is enacted
of
there.
Tajikistan will be citing your statement here in court today and quoting portions of your brief, and it will then say that this thing on the website is not valid as a matter of Tajikistan law. It's a contract of adhesion, or as the plaintiff would have it, it's not a contract at all, or it's just noise. And since Hyatt itself says that the wrong occurs where the computer screen is located, obviously the balance of contacts will subject Hyatt to the mercy of the Tajikistan judiciary.
Well, Your Honor, I guess I have a couple
of... Is this really what you want? I mean, this is not the normal line taken by proprietors of websites which is that we are suable in every jurisdiction in the world all the time.
And Judge, to be clear, the position Hyatt takes is clearly not that they are amenable to suit in any jurisdiction, although I suppose a given tribal court in a remote location could ignore the express language of the contract any time they want. I suppose that's one consequence of a global economy. But in a case like this, the contract on the website is very clear both about where disputes must be brought and about how they must be brought. Were someone to characterize this as a contract of adhesion, I suppose we might cite back to that tribunal, this court's decision in the famous Metro East arbitration case, where the court talked about the ability of grown-ups to sign away rights like that.
Any evidence that that represents Tajikistan law?
Probably not, Your Honor, and I am admittedly ill-educated on those principles today. But to
be
clear,
on the basis of your argument, you're going to have to do some swift learning about the law of Mauritania as well.
Or decide to start to settle a lot.
Well, yeah, with respect, Your Honor, as I said a moment ago, there are more than two contacts here. There are probably seven contacts here, and if I could complete articulating them, I think it may be clear why this problem perhaps is not as significant as it may at first appear. There is a substantial connection between this case and London.
By the way, does the Class Action Fairness Act allow you to remove a case from the district court in Tajikistan?
I'm going to need to check legislative history on that, Your Honor. I think that may have been silent in the text.
Hey, sorry about the interruption.
Judge, just to complete the thought on where the contacts here are, particularly because the plaintiff who relies on these contacts has not yet articulated them. There is a company headquartered in Illinois. There is a website viewed in England. There is the act of entering in reservation information and accepting terms and conditions that occurred in England. There is a hotel stay in Russia. There is the presentation of a bill in Russia, as Your Honor articulated a few moments ago. There is then, interestingly, in the complaint, a separate transaction with the United States, and that is the decision to pay the bill using an American Express card. It's not in the complaint, but it happens that American Express is a company headquartered in New York. So there are multiple locations, both in the United States and elsewhere, that have connections to the case. None of this has anything to do with forum selection.
I take it this was a dollar-denominated American Express card rather than a pound-denominated card?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I'm not aware of that fact. It's clearly not in the complaint, and so all we know is where the corporation, American Express Corporation, is headquartered. That happens to be New York.
But they issue cards that are billed in many currencies.
Sure.
You can get an American Express card that's billed in Swiss francs.
Absolutely. And it may well be that that's an additional contact to London for all we know, but what we know for certain is that's not a contact with Illinois. In the end, the only contact with Illinois is the same contact that existed in the Avery case, and that is that Hyatt happens to have its headquarters down the street here in the Loop. We submit under Avery, that's clearly not sufficient. But having discussed all that, and I think that issue is as clear probably as it could be under the decision of the Illinois Supreme Court, let me turn for a moment to the significance of the contract between the two parties. First of all, we find it odd that plaintiffs would argue there is no contract because a substantial part of their legal position is that there's a choice of law clause. If there is a choice of law
they
clause...
They apparently think that there is a contract, and that's its only clause.
Right. Well, precisely. One of the things I do for a living is defend credit card companies, and oftentimes people argue that the cancellation and terminability provisions are not legitimate, but the interest rate provisions
are.
Let
me ask
you,
at the risk of making a federal case out of this dispute, if the plaintiff would have contacted Hyatt and said, look, you said this room was going to be $502 a night, which is pretty expensive to begin with. And with the exchange rate they used, it was $576 a night. I had to stay three nights. Why doesn't Hyatt pay me three times 74, the difference, which was quoted? Isn't that the simple way to resolve this case?
Sure. I mean, it well could be, Your Honor. I will tell you, I don't know Hyatt's policies in that circumstance, but I do know an analogous policy, which is if Mr. Shaw had shown up having made a reservation on the website and no room was available, I can tell you that Hyatt would have made another room available in the city at another hotel at its expense if the price was different. I know that for a fact, and I think that's a further a background reason for understanding the relationship to be a contractual one. But as I say, the clearer reason is that the plaintiff himself concedes there was something about this website that was binding because, at a minimum, the choice of law provision of the terms and conditions evidences an agreement. Plainly, as Judge Easterbrook pointed out earlier, there was consideration for the agreement because Hyatt reserved a room and incurred the opportunity cost associated with setting aside a room for Mr. Shaw. And at the same time, Mr. Shaw promised that if he didn't show up, he'd pay for that room and compensate Hyatt for the opportunity cost. So in our view, that has all of the hallmarks of a contract. It was in writing. It was expressed. There was an agreement and consideration on both sides. That sounds to us very much like a contract. Question is, for purposes of this lawsuit, what is the legal significance of that contract? And we submit that that contract requires dismissal of both the Consumer Fraud Act claim and also the unjust enrichment claim. Now, Judge Leinenweber below did not address this alternative ground as a basis for dismissing the Consumer Fraud Act claim, but Illinois state law, which governs in this diversity action, is very clear that the Consumer Fraud Act is not intended as a substitute for contract actions. The best case on that point, I think, is the Zankel case from the Illinois Court of Appeals, where the court looked at a contract where a landscaper promised to deliver one service at a certain value and, in fact, delivered a less valuable service. The landscaper was sued under the Consumer Fraud Act, and the State Court of Appeals said that is, if anything, a breach of contract action, which may not be remedied by dint of the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act. Same thing here. Mr. Shaw contends that he was promised a hotel room at a particular price, and he was given that hotel room at a higher price. That is, if anything, a breach of an agreement, should have been alleged in contract, and if he thought he could allege the elements of a contract claim consistent with Rule 11, that was his remedy under Illinois law. But Zankel and the other authorities cited in our brief, I think, make clear under Illinois law that there is no Consumer Fraud Act claim for that independent reason. Finally, Your Honors, I would point out that it is Hornbook law and probably goes back to Blackstone that the existence of an express contract nullifies the unjust enrichment claim. Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Cohen?
Very briefly, Your Honor.
That's guaranteed. I think you've got about 30 seconds.
Even if there was a contract here, under Avery, if there is a contract plus more, it is recognizable under the consumer statute. That's at page 31, I believe, of our brief. It doesn't matter whether the deception was in London. Avery specifically states that the location of the deception is irrelevant, and that's at page 853 of the Avery opinion. Mm-hmm. And lastly...
Thank you, counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.